Good afternoon and welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. I'm Justice Bob McCoy, and on my left is Justice Sue Walker, and on my right is Justice Lee Ann Dolfino. We have three cases being submitted with oral argument today, and we have three cases being submitted without oral argument. Would you call the first case?
Court calls CPL Thompson Texas et al. Versus Washington Homes and Sheffield Development. At Pleasant Court, Mr. Ryan Rutherford will argue for the appellant. Mr. Daniel McKay will argue for Washington Homes, and Mr. Gino Zini will argue for Sheffield Development.
Let's proceed.
May it please the court. My name is Brian Rutherford, and I represent the appellants, whom I'll collectively refer to as CTL. One issue that's out of the gate is we have the jurisdictional motion, and just to be clear, CTL does concede that this court does not have jurisdiction to review the trial court's July 3, 2008 order denying CTL's Chapter 150 dismissal motion. I improvidently filed that. I've withdrawn it in response to the motion. This case does present several issues for this court to decide under Chapter 150, and we're certainly aware that this court has decided the first case, has decided a recent case, which directly addressed several issues. I'm going to spend about 10 minutes on the front end and 10 minutes on the back end since I'm responding to two appellees, and I'd like to focus primarily on the factual basis of each claim because I believe that's most likely what this court would like to hear about in light of Parker County. The Parker County case, as written and as we've read it and as it's been interpreted so far in trial courts across the state, is about contract. You've got a clear contract statement in there. You have a clear adoption of a specific contractual duty. And this court's opinion in Parker County focused on that contractual duty, looked at the pleadings of the plaintiff, which addressed that specific contractual duty and alleged that all of the damages flowed from that contractual duty, and arrived at this is something that's not covered by Chapter 150. In this particular situation, we're asking the court to distinguish Parker County. We're asking the court to look behind the pleadings, as this court and other courts have done, to look at the kind of facts claimed, to look at the allegations, and that look at the damages. Morrison Homes has pled claims for professional negligence, negligent misrepresentation, breach of implied warranty. Then also brought up fraud in a real estate transaction in 2009. Sheffield in 2008, contribution, indemnity, relying on Hill House's negligence certificate. And then in 2010, professional negligence, breach of contract, express warranty. We would argue to this court that the claims brought by Morrison Homes all derive from negligence. They're all arising out of professional negligence. Sheffield, slightly different. There is a contract. However, we look to what the contract actually says and what was actually pled by Sheffield. And in this particular situation, there is no particular contractual duty other than a general negligence duty, professional standard of care, that has been identified as causing the particular claims that they've got in this case. So we would argue that Parker County is distinguishable in that it is not based solely on a contract. It is not based solely on a contractual duty that's been specifically identified. And if it were, certainly counsel for Sheffield would have pointed this court to any place in the record where there is a specific contractual duty outside of the general standard of care. So for those reasons, I would argue that Parker County, issued by this court, by Justice Dofano, is distinguishable on that basis. We've got contractual claims specifically pled in that case. We don't have them here. We have a general allegation. You didn't do what you were supposed to do as a geotech in rendering professional services. So we'd argue it's distinguishable. The waiver issue is something that's been brought up by both sides, Morrison Homes and by Sheffield. It is undisputed that CTL engaged in written discovery. It's undisputed that we previously filed a motion to dismiss back in 2008 on some limited claims, the four homes at issue. It's undisputed that we filed an MSJ, but I think it's important to look at the timing on the filing of these things because we filed the MSJ. We filed the 2010 motion to dismiss under Chapter 150 that we're talking about here today. We had the hearing on the Chapter 150 motion. After that, we had one issue And it's very explicitly stated in the Supplemental Clerk's Record, Volume 3, page 609, that the trial court considered one issue on the summary judgment. And that was an order that was issued after we had perfected the appeal on Chapter 150. So to the extent that we're talking about time, to the extent we're talking about having gone down and had a partial summary judgment hearing, I would argue that those are not evidence of waiver.
You didn't mention the length of time between the filing and the motion to dismiss.
Did not, Your Honor. Ustanek, the Waco Court of Appeals,
so
looked at
you
that.
I did not. Because the time length was?
The time length was over 2 years. From the initial.
Over 2 years?
Say that again, I'm sorry.
Wasn't it considerably over 2 years?
It was. The original filing was in 2007, May of 2007, the plaintiff's original petition, and then we filed our motion to dismiss. On that claim, it was prior to July of 2010, so roughly 3 years. That's correct. In Ustanek, Waco Court of Appeals looked at the length of time, looked at MSJ, and held that 27 months was not a waiver when you're actively addressing the issue. And certainly there are other things that are going on behind the scenes and moving the cases forward, but I would argue that there's certainly nothing wrong with proceeding with a dual-pronged Chapter 150 dismissal motion based on all the claims that are out there and a summary judgment and just buttoning everything up.
Well, seems rather curious that in a medical malpractice you have to do it within 120 days because it is what it is. It says what it says.
That is correct, Your Honor. And candidly, I've attempted to look at the legislative history, and this court stated in Palladian that there's not a lot. I ordered the transcripts of the little bit of hearing there was, the talking about it, and the distinction between Chapter 74 and Chapter 150, for right or wrong, is under Chapter 74, you have the medical profession, the healthcare profession, and their insurers present. On the other side, you've got plaintiff's lawyers, and there's a meeting of the minds, there's back and forth. And on Chapter 150, again, for right or wrong, there wasn't that conversation happening. So we don't have that express limit as we do in Chapter 74. And it is certainly within the legislature's purview to put that in there, and they chose not to do it in this situation.
But really, here, there is a certificate of merit. There is an affidavit.
There is. I'm just talking about the length of time before we move to dismiss on all the claims.
Right. But here, there is an affidavit, a certificate of merit, whichever you would like to call it.
Yes, ma'am. That is correct, and I'm happy to address those two issues as well. Regarding the sufficiency of the affidavit, we've raised two challenges. We've, of course, said that Mr. Hillhouse has not met the statutory standard under Chapter 150, which has changed in 2009 slightly, but under this applicable version, he stated that he is actively engaged in the practice of engineering and that he's been in the practice of performing forensic geological studies. And looking at...
And he also says he's familiar with the standard of care for engineers practicing in North Texas.
That is correct. And he's saying all engineers. And I find that difficult to fathom that addresses Chapter 150.
What is the purpose of 150? Is it not the same as in Chapter 74?
It is
to put you on notice of what the claim is and to give some threshold indication of merit?
That is the inference. Yes, sir.
And your position is this doesn't do that? You don't know what the claims are that are being pled against you?
I'm saying two things. I'm saying that Mr. Hillhouse is not qualified in the four corners of this particular affidavit.
Okay. And you're saying?
And I am saying that this particular affidavit does not address.
Does not put you on notice of what the claim is about.
Looking at the affidavit itself, it says that he, talking about the standard of care issue in particular, he is saying that from his experience, this particular standard can underpredict potential ground movements. He doesn't say what the correct standard may be. He doesn't say we misapplied the standard. He doesn't say we should have applied a different standard or method. And for that reason, I would argue that it does not put us on notice as to that particular claim. And with that, I will reserve for rebuttal.
Good afternoon. My name is Daniel McCabe. I represent Morrison Homes, which is one of the appellees. Morrison Homes is the plaintiff in the case. Starting backward forward, Jim Hillhouse's affidavit clearly expresses what was done wrong. It is identified as negligence. He then expresses what should have been done. A combination of the two methodologies should have been used, and the data that was drawn from them should have been incorporated into the analysis so that the report would be accurate, so that the subsequent purchaser of the land, my client Morrison Homes, would not have been going on bad data. Consequently, the damages that occurred would not have occurred.
What about his correct assertion that what your affidavit says with regard to his familiarity of the standard of care is that it just says, I'm familiar with standard industry practices in North Texas for professional engineers? Well, I was a professional engineer, but I wouldn't know up from down from this question here, and his knowledge of what I used to practice, which was industrial engineering, is meaningless. So
do you
think he has a point about at least narrowing in to this area of engineering?
He has a good point if the affidavit stopped there. What they appear to be requesting is a conclusory, inadmissible, objectionable statement of it satisfies the standard of care. I say so. What he does go on for four pages and analyze is, in addition to identifying himself as doing geotechnical forensic work, i.e. looking back at what has been done, which was necessary, he goes into the methodology that should have been used and states that in using their own numbers, in using their own results, he could have accurately concluded that the soil needed to be remediated. Of course, in Texas, an engineer is a licensed engineer, and there is no sub-licensing that can occur. Nonetheless, that is not what Mr. Hillhouse did. He is not an electrical engineer. He's a geotech, and he states so in his affidavit.
I know. I think what he was looking for is that I'm familiar with standard industry practices in North Texas for forensic geotechnical engineering.
I think that, yes. I understand. I think that the substance of the affidavit makes clear in an admissible fashion that he is qualified to give the opinion he gave with regard to the standard of care for geotechnical work in North Texas. And, of course, the statute doesn't speak to it. There is no it's not a promulgated affidavit akin to what you see in Texas Rule of Evidence 902. It is left to the engineer to state the standard.
Do I recall in Chapter 74 that it specifically sets out standard of care as one of the requirements of the report?
You are correct, and that is not done.
Would be, well, the legislature knew how to put that in the statute. If it wanted it in this statute, they would put it in.
The legislature absolutely knew how to do it. Criterium Farrell, the Beaumont Court of Appeals, pointed that out as well, that was not done in this instance. The substance of the Hillhouse affidavit demonstrates it. If I could touch upon the lack of jurisdiction in this case, the first motion to dismiss was filed approximately a year after the case was filed. Palladium admits that there is no clear standard on when a waiver might occur. However, 2 years later, a second motion to dismiss was filed on the eve of trial. And what counsel did not point out is that during that time, the appellants adopted the pleadings on negligence for claims against our fellow appellee, Sheffield. They said, we adopt those negligence claims, implicitly adopting the certificate of merit. And that, even though Palladium admits it's not a clear standard, it's not been established, that certainly should be a substantive action that could lead to waiver. And that adoption as part of a counterclaim against Sheffield was made between the filing of the first motion to dismiss and the argument thereon. So it was well before, certainly, the second motion to dismiss. Now, the second motion to dismiss is akin to a motion for rehearing or a motion for reconsideration, as was discussed in the Denton County Court. The relief requested is exactly the same relief. Dismiss them. Dismiss their claims with prejudice. Likewise, we acknowledge there are two more points that were brought up. In addition to the fact that every single manifestation of damages wasn't discussed, as mentioned in the first motion to dismiss, then they come up with, well, Mr. Hillhouse's affidavit is insufficient, and there's no discussion of the standard of care. Well, although those are two additional points, it's our submission that you could continually file motion to dismiss after motion to dismiss after motion to dismiss and come up with some new spin on it. At some point, there needs to be a conclusion that you are done. And likewise, when read in conjunction with the power of with your opportunity for interlocutory appeal, then you certainly can be found to have been done. Now, I'm sorry, where's my time? I don't want to cut into Mr. 2 minutes left on my 8. Okay, thank you. Oh, there's the yellow light. So they did not, as they admit in the record, take advantage of the interlocutory appeal after the first motion to dismiss. They chose not to file a motion, an interlocutory appeal.
Was the July 8th order?
That was in the summer of 2008, yes. Yes, I would say that they pulled the rug out from under themselves. They have to acknowledge that the 2008 order is a dead letter with regard to interlocutory appeal. However, when read in conjunction with the Denton County Court, it is proper to conclude that the 2010 motion to dismiss was more properly characterized as a motion for reconsideration or a motion for rehearing, and consequently, it in and of itself likewise does not create a separate, distinctive, appealable interlocutory order. And so, yes. Now, at the end of the case, maybe an appeal. But finally, what I would emphasize with regard to their use of the continuous motion to dismiss practice, Chapter 150 is not an amendment of Rule 166A. At some point, you move beyond the threshold analysis. At some point, you move beyond the frivolous analysis, and you get into the case. Subsequently, then, the analysis is a motion for summary judgment or a motion for directed verdict at trial. But using the motion to dismiss process in this fashion would prevent the case ever from getting to trial.
How is this parallel or not parallel to Chapter 74?
It is parallel, probably, as counsel has said, in that it is a threshold analysis to prevent frivolous claims against professionals.
No, I'm talking about multiple motions to dismiss. I don't recall filing multiple motions to dismiss.
Yes, it's my understanding that Chapter 74 prevents a motion to dismiss from being filed too deeply into the case.
May it please the Court, Gino Rossini for Sheffield Development Company, Inc. I might refer to my client as either Sheffield or SDC, as it's otherwise known. We're the contribution defendant. We bring contribution claims. We are co-defendants with CTL in the underlying litigation. I'd like to briefly address appellant's points regarding Sheffield's breach of contract and breach of express warranty claims. Those claims do sound in contract as opposed to in tort. The court's attention was directed to its Parker County decision, and we believe that that analysis should be applied here. In that decision, the court set forth that the same contract might create both contractual and tort duties, and if tort duties are breached, that might be a negligence claim. But as pled here, Sheffield has pled a contract breach, and this contract clearly sets forth contractual duties on two scores. It is true that Sheffield did not cite to Line and Page as to which provisions were breached in its initial pleading. However, there's really no dispute as to what is at issue because CTL attached the letter agreement, the contract between the parties, to its own traditional motion for summary judgment against Sheffield that it filed in the trial court before even seeking its dismissal under Chapter 150. And the entire import of the contract, the scope of work, provides that CTL will conduct borings at the project site and analyze those borings and come up with a geotechnical report. The facts set forth in the Hill House affidavit are that, that CTL provided a bad report because it did not follow the appropriate combination of methodologies in coming up with the geotechnical numbers that were reported. And that's exactly what they contracted to do with Sheffield. The second issue is the breach of express warranty. The express warranty within the contract, and this is a form that CTL provided, stated that they would perform work under the contract, quote, will be performed in a manner consistent with that level of care and skill ordinarily exercised by members of the profession currently practicing under similar conditions in the locality of the project. Now, that might sound very similar to a tort standard of negligence, but it also is the express words that they chose to be bound by in their warranty of their work. Therefore, regardless of whether or not we have a negligence claim, which we believe we do, Sheffield also has a breach of express warranty claim. That's exactly what Parker County recognized, that you might have a contract creating both contractual and tort obligations. Next, I'd like to go to the argument that Sheffield properly filed the Hill House affidavit with its first.
Roslyn?
Yes.
Now, regardless of what Parker County says, a duck's a duck's a duck. You can't change a medical malpractice case into a contract claim by claiming that I contracted for medical services and breached it by not providing them properly. But you're saying in a professional engineering services agreement you can?
Yes. And in fact, I mean, I'd hate to say it happens all the time without having the case law behind me, but I do know that Texarkana Court of Appeals just on November 1st had a Chapter 150 case that they decided that hasn't been cited in any of the briefs because it's too recent. But that was a case in which Paris ISD sued their engineering firm for breach of contract and sought a disgorgement of the fees already prepared. That's a breach of contract claim.
You're just suggesting that although we can look to the Med-Mal Act in certain circumstances, this is not one.
Correct, Your Honor.
You can't do that in Med-Mal, but you can do it in engineering. Okay.
Yes.
Okay, so your live pleading had claims against CTL for contribution and indemnity, and you're saying 150 just flat doesn't apply to claims for contribution and indemnity.
We have several arguments, Your Honor. The live claim includes contribution and negligence, a direct negligence cause of action, a breach of contract cause of action, and a breach of express warranty cause of action.
Right, and that's what I understood. You're saying that it just doesn't apply to contribution and indemnity. And then concerning the breach of contract and the express warranty claims, which you just covered, you're saying that Parker County governs those, so 150 doesn't apply to those claims.
Correct.
Which leaves you with your negligence claim, which you're saying your incorporation of Hill House's affidavit covers that claim.
Yes. And briefly, the incorporation of the Hill House affidavit, there is no requirement in Chapter 150 stating that a contribution defendant should have to procure its own expert to come up with its own expert report to prove the plaintiff's negligence claim. And I would invite the court not to expand Chapter 150 to require that. It says that the plaintiff will file a qualifying affidavit. Not only that, but to get into the issue of physical filing, stapling the Hill House affidavit as opposed to incorporating it by reference, our position is it doesn't serve any purpose under the statute to require that type of duplication. This is an expert report that was on file with the trial court more than a year before the cross claims were even brought by Sheffield. And in fact, CTL had already filed its motion to dismiss under Chapter 150 with respect to Morrison Homes, again, before Sheffield sought to incorporate that affidavit by reference. There's no doubt or dispute as to which affidavit we were talking about, and no reason why the wouldn't necessarily need to be physically attached to the pleading as opposed to incorporated by reference. And just briefly to point out that Rule 58 of the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure expressly allows a pleading to incorporate by reference another pleading. It actually says statements in a pleading may be incorporated, which includes cases analyzing Rule 58 in the summary judgment context have held that to be argument and also evidence. Very briefly, the argument with respect to waiver, I don't want to repeat the arguments that have already been made, but my time is up, so I won't. Thank you.
Justice McCoy, you asked about Chapter 74. Chapter 74 explicitly states that if you're going to complain about it, you got to do it within a window of time. If you're ever going to do it, you got to do it then. Chapter 150 does not have that requirement, and we would ask the court not to create that requirement. With respect to Sheffield, there was a... Yes, sir.
The immediacy of getting it filed because of the purpose of it, and then some sort of limited time to respond, a reasonable time or something. That's all I was saying.
Yes, sir. There was a question with respect to Sheffield about what it was they pled and what it was they relied on. And I'll certainly agree. Rule 58 does say you can adopt any pleadings, et cetera. The case law, interpretive case law, says one of the reasons for that is let's not file a bunch of paper with the court. We don't have to. Completely agree. Question is it make any difference under Chapter 150 that you have a specific statute and it defines this narrow thing? You got to have a plaintiff and you got to have somebody that files this certificate contemporaneously with the original petition.
But you already had it, right?
As to the plaintiff, that is correct, Your Honor.
Well,
the question is, does it make any difference as to Sheffield's claims, which were brought later? Do we relate back? Do we create that new law? Do we look narrowly to the statute and say that anybody who's complaining about it has to bring their own? And the reason I think it makes a difference in this case is looking to the pleadings. Clerk's Record 259, that is the Sheffield's cross-claim, where they specifically have a breach of contract pled. CTL breached their contract with Sheffield as described in the Certificate of Merit filed by plaintiff. Certificate of Merit filed by plaintiff says you're negligent. Well, which one is it? If we're going beyond that, if we're going to say that there's something else beyond the negligence in the plaintiff's, Morrison Holmes's certificate filed by Hill House, then what is it? We had to have notice of it. That's my argument.
Will you respond to the argument that you adopted Hill House's certificate of merit when you adopted the pleadings against Sheffield?
Certainly. The beginning of each of those sentences is in the unlikely event that the plaintiff recovers, then we have a contribution claim. It's conditional. Each statement is conditioned the whole way throughout. Additionally, if we were pinned in that way, those are compulsory counterclaims, and we would have had to waive them. So we conditionally pled it. In the unlikely event that they were able to succeed, then we also have a contribution claim. And I would argue that that's not waiver because it's compulsory.
Are you going to comment on the one bite at the apple argument? Can't keep biting at the apple and getting an interlocutory appeal.
Yes, sir. I would certainly agree that there needs to be a cutoff. There's not one in the statute. I would certainly agree that there needs to be one.
There's not one, as I recall, in Chapter 74.
There's the one opportunity to cure. So if you complain about it, you take it up, Court of Appeals says, yes, this is no good, let's send it back down. Plaintiff has the opportunity one time, 30 days, to cure.
I don't think the defendant can continually complain about the expert's report if it loses, although I don't recall it saying you're limited to one complaint about the expert's report.
And I don't have the case site in front of me because it's been a few months since I've looked at Chapter 74, but there is one case that says you do get another interlocutory appeal from that second fix. And our
fixes.
Say that again.
Fixes.
Correct.
Talking about here, it just doesn't make any sense.
here's the report, you know what it is, it says what it says. If it isn't up to snuff,
certainly
you try to get rid of it. But you can't keep trying to get rid of it, because theoretically you could never go to trial because there'd always be interrogatory appeals.
It'd be a moving target. That's right, Judge. And I think what helps there is having a pleading deadline where you've got everything cut off. Because here we have four different pleadings.
Well, is a motion to dismiss a pleading?
No, it's a okay. Outset motion. Well, we've got four pleadings in this case. We've got the plaintiff's original petition where they bring some claims. They got some other claims and an amended petition in 2009. Sheffield, same thing. They got the original cross claims in 08, amended in 10. Then we got a pleading cutoff. We know what all the claims are. Does the Chapter 150 certificate address them or not? So I think at that point, I'm done. I've got to grab everything there is out there before the pleading deadline, take it up if I'm going to, and then I'm done. I would agree with that. Because otherwise I'm going to have a moving target of, okay, now they've got this new claim for, say, negligent misrepresentation. Now I've got to address that in an amended Chapter 150 or supplemental Chapter 150 motion. And we certainly have an interplay of these things in the trial court of where do we stop, where are we cut off, when do we address these issues. And I would argue, standing here with a straight face, with my credibility, that's what we did. We've got four amended petitions out there. We've got different claims that are brought up. They're all in. There's a deadline. Let's move for summary judgment. Let's move for a Chapter 150 dismissal. And again, I concede, not on the claim from 2008 on the four properties. That's out. But for the things that are in, let's move for dismissal on them, see what happens, move for summary judgment on everything that's left.
But doesn't the statute itself really address, I mean, I think the statute addresses what you're saying, because it says that the certificate of merit or affidavit shall set forth specifically at least one negligent act, error, omission. So there's no requirement. You know, unlike Chapter 74, which is more extensive, you just have to set forth one act or omission. So there's no requirement that it cover all the claims that a plaintiff could ever bring by filing amended petitions.
I agree with that, and I would argue that it's an unsettled question because of the split between San Antonio and Austin going one way and saying only something that's called negligence versus Corpus Christi and Houston and Waco saying it's anything. We look at the claims. We look at the underlying claim that's being pled. Because of that split in authority, I think I've got to address it all. Anytime there's a new claim, I've got to not waive it. And, again, there's not a case that's saying that one way or the other. There's only one case that I know of that has gone up on petition to the Texas Supreme Court, and that is Benchmark Engineering out of the 14th Court of Appeals. And the issues are not all the same as this issue, but there is waiver in there. There is the sufficiency of the qualifications and the sufficiency of the affidavit. So until we have some guidance, I think it's the safest thing for us practitioners to do, and that's why we've done it here.
Is just to put you on notice of what the claim is about. And you're saying that basically I'm going to wait until after my motion for summary judgment is filed, 7 days before trial, where he can't file another pleading before I file this thing. Well, after that, tens of thousands of dollars of discovery have gone on, possibly of your client and his, possibly without purpose, only to find out that the report wasn't good enough, which could have been done day one.
There is that argument if all the claims were brought on day one. I would agree. But if they're brought piecemeal throughout, there's got to be a cutoff line that I can identify so that I can move on all of them. And that's what we've done here. And in the absence of a deadline, in the absence of a specific statutory guidance on what waiver might be, what a time limit might be, I think we've got to do that to protect ourselves on this side. The jurisdictional question, I believe I've answered, but just in case I haven't, Justice Walker, our position is we have dropped the 2008 issue entirely. That is correct under this court's law and other law that's out there. But the 2010, we timely filed a notice of appeal. It was based on claims that were not pled at the time that the first one was filed. And for these reasons, CTL asked the court to hold the trial court abused its discretion when it issued its July 26, 2010 order denying the Chapter 150 dismissal motion.
Okay, let's just
yes, sir.
Get away from that. But if those two courts are correct, that this is a literal reading of one cause of action, when you gave up on your first motion to dismiss, it seems to me that that verifies that you didn't do the interlocutory appeal. That verified that there's at least one meritorious claim in there, and it doesn't make any difference if you keep adding it because the statute just says one.
And again, because there's this dichotomy.
So, but if those two courts are correct, then this dog ain't gonna hunt. You're relying on the other courts that say we've got to address each one as they're filed, as opposed to the report only needs one viable cause of action.
That's correct.
Meritorious claim.
That's correct.
I'm with you.
Okay. And we would ask the court to remand judgment, render judgment that CTL is entitled to dismissal of all the claims against it, both Morrison Homes and Sheffield, remand to the trial court to decide whether the dismissal should be with or without prejudice. Thank you.
Okay. Well, for some reason, we have a scheduling snafu.
Your Honor, I am arguing the 3 o'clock case as well. I don't
know
if opposing counsel is here.
We should have had 2 at 1:30 and not 1 at 1:30. So if you see opposing counsel come in, would you tell her?
I will do it, Judge.
Go ahead and go with it. And you're going to be on the lookout for her and the other case.
Yeah.
All right. We are in recess until we...